I'm going to tell you about what apparently is a purely theoretical issue. What is the nature of the critical fluctuation spectrum in a dissipative XY model? The dissipative quantum XY model was first proposed in connection with the superconducting insulator transitions in thin films. There were some lovely experiments by Goldman and Art Hebert and others. The model was first proposed in 86 by Chakraborty, independently by Chakraborty, Kielsen, and Ingold Luther, and by Matthew Fisher. I find that this model is also applicable to the phase transition for which there is evidence in the pseudo-gap region of the cuprates. And this I have talked about quite a bit in the last 8 or 10 years. And I will not talk about the applicability of this model to this particular phase transition, because that will take too much time. So I would rather talk about two new theoretical results. One is that one can show that the simplest model that you can think of a incommensurate itinerant antiferromagnet with a phase transition at finite Q maps to a model which is the XY model with a phase transition at Q equal to zero. This is unpublished work. Then I will talk about an analytic solution to this done by Vivek Aji and me a few years ago, and a test of this, which is about to get written. It has been written up, but not sent, by Li Junqiu and me by Quantum Monte Carlo. The plan of the talk is to very quickly go over this first thing. What do we mean by local quantum critical fluctuations and need for introducing them in cuprates, antiferromagnetic quantum criticality in heavy fermions, and in possibly in ion-based superconductors? Since I want to stick to results for which they ought to be, which are just direct theoretical results, and there are issues here which are matters of discernment and judgment, I will simply state what I believe and not discuss that much. So let me quickly go to the history of introducing the idea of local quantum criticality. Very early in the physics of cuprates in 1987 and 88, it became clear, these lines were not yet known, but everybody was making varieties of cuprates and tuning them to get the highest TC. And when they were measuring the normal state properties in this region, they were encountering something which had never been seen before in the physics of metals, but was remarkably simply characterized. Resistivity had a temperature dependence proportional to temperature. Conductivity was going as 1 over omega log omega. Raman scattering was roughly a constant with a cutoff which was at least a couple of tenths of a volt. Nuclear relaxation rate had a constant term. So if you multiplied T1 with a T and took the inverse, it would look like not the Coringa term constant, but would have a 1 over T contribution. And it became evident, immediately clear, that Landau theory did not work in the normal state. The point of view that a few colleagues of mine and I took on this problem was that all those diverse anomalies should come from one and the same basic physics, and that should be the basic physics not only of this region but of superconductivity and subsequently of this region as well. So the diverse anomalies must all come from one and the same basic physics, and finding it is the central problem in the cuprates, and I would then claim also in the heavy fermion superconductors and the iron pectides. Why are they diverse, and why should one introduce local quantum criticality? Well, if you look at Raman scattering, which measures a long wavelength property as a function of frequency, you find that the measured intensity is a constant. The measured intensity is cotangent hyperbolic omega over 2t from the detailed balance factor. If you measure it on the whichever side they're measuring it, Stokes or anti-Stokes. So S of omega had to have a scale which was related to temperature. If you look at a completely different property, nuclear relaxation rate, which is measuring some property at omega 10 to 0 integrated over Q, you had a singular term. This is the normal Fermi liquid term, and this is a singular term. And this is just by example. One wanted a simple characterization of both, and one knew that Landau-Fermi liquid did not work. For example, in Landau-Fermi liquid theory, the S of omega from Raman scattering would cut off at k times Vf, Vf where k is the wave vector of light. So this would cut off at a few hundred centimeter inverse. And of course, there's no way of getting linear resistivity. What we hit upon is that, well, a absorptive part of a susceptibility has to be odd in frequency. That we cannot abandon. But instead of a scale, which is a parameter in the Hamiltonian, we said, supposing the scale is a function of temperature itself, and then a constant, and then with a cutoff, then we have a high density of low energy excitations, and as if p goes to zero, this term, there should be a minus sign here by causality. This is minus in calculus. Then this is a signum function, and the Kramers Kronig of a signum function is a log, which implies that we are dealing with a problem in which there's a putative singularity in the real part of some susceptibility in the limit of t going to zero. Besides explaining those properties, it predicts a few things. It predicts, for example, that the single particle scattering rate should be proportional to t or omega and independent of momentum. We had to assume, to understand the diversity of anomalies, that this fluctuation spectrum, although it had it's a singular in frequency, was more or less independent of momentum. This also, of course, immediately predicts a T log T specific heat in the region in which this thing applies, meaning about the superconducting transition temperature. So this is a new paradigm for criticality, because one is saying that the real part of susceptibility is diverging, but one is also saying that, incidentally, if you have this particular form, if you Fourier transform it, then in imaginary time, it is like 1 over time. Okay, there's a correlation function in time which is going as 1 over time, so it's scale invariant. But it has no diverging length scale associated with it. And this business seemed completely crazy when I joined Bell Labs. Everybody was walking back and forth talking dynamic scaling, and one knew that in classical critical phenomena the spatial length scales and temporal length scales should be related. This seemed crazy, but by the time this came along, I knew enough theory to disregard theorists when there were some predictions which were fulfilled. For example, only around 1998 was ARPIS developed enough to see that around the region of the Fermi surface that could be measured very well from the diagonal direction to about 30-35 degrees, not only was the scattering rate T and omega, but it was in magnitude within 10% the same in all directions and perpendicular to the Fermi surface. So we began to believe this, and the big question was, well, we proposed a fluctuation spectrum, but what is this a fluctuation of? What is a fluctuation? And by that time, it had become clear that this thing did not have to do with any critical properties of antiferromagnetism. There are all kinds of other things that happen here, and if you look at the free energy associated with them, they are minuscule. I'm not going to talk about the details, as I said, of the cuprates and why the model that I'm going to talk about applies to it. Well, let me just point out that here in the Pnictides, and there's some data that I can show at the end of my talk if you're not already familiar with it, although Pnictides is not a game that I have followed until very recently in great detail from the experimental point of view. But there is a region here where the resistivity is linear in temperature. Thermal power, which is the entropy per electron, is T log T. And now recently, James Analytis has done an experiment reducing the superconducting transition temperature with a magnetic field. And the resistivity is a homogeneous function of modulus of the magnetic field divided by temperature, which is another statement of the kind of omega over T criticality that I'm speaking about. In heavy fermions, we know, again, some compounds, but not all, in which the resistivity is T, the specific heat is T log T, and at least in one case, cerium copper 6, there is a measurement of the bipolarized neutron of the fluctuation spectrum, which I will speak details of it only at the end if there are questions. Let me first of all come to one of the results that I can state about the relationship of the antiferromagnetic, itinerant antiferromagnetic quantum critical problem to the problem, which I'm not going to talk about from microscopic theory. This is not working, is it? It is. Okay. There is an order parameter, and the only order parameter known to occur consistently in five different cuprate families that I've looked at, is an order which maps to an XY model with fourfold anisotropy. And I believe if I have to study the quantum criticality of that, I study the dissipative XY model. And I'm going to now tell you why, for studying a simple model for itinerant antiferromagnetism, I also have to, if I know something about the dissipative XY model, I know about the itinerant antiferromagnetism problem. I should emphasize that these problems have a lot more features. This is the model compared to the model that I'm going to talk about. I'm only going to talk to you about itinerant antiferromagnetism in a one-band Hubbard model. Okay? And these materials, heavy fermions, they have to have multiple bands. Iron selenides, they have multiple bands. But I can tell you, and work can be done on that, but I'm going to tell you just about this, because I know what to do with it. So the statement is that there exists a canonical transformation between a repulsive model at arbitrary filling and a decorated attractive Hubbard model at finite Zeeman field. Now, there is a simpler version of this, which has been known for 30 years, or maybe 40 years. It is commonly attributed to Shiba, which is the relationship between the repulsive Hubbard model at half filling with chemical potential zero and the attractive Hubbard model. But actually, it turns out that there is a poor Czech who actually some 10 or 15 years before Shiba wrote a paper on it, and Shiba forgot about, Shiba did not know about him, and I've forgotten his name, okay? But in my paper, he'll be referred to. Okay, so here is the Hubbard model, and my work is to generalize this transformation to arbitrary filling, which leads to some very pretty conclusions. I'm also going to add an anisotropy term by which I can turn the antiferromagnetism to be in the plane or either or icing-like. And I'm going to have a general chemical potential. And in general, this model away from half-filling has an incommensurate antiferromagnetic transition at a wave vector, which I will call q sub 0 plus small q sub 0. And q sub 0 will be the commensurate wave vector, and q 0 is the difference from commensuration. Okay.
Chandra, is it important to have icing or easy plane?
At one point I thought so, but for what I'm going to talk about, it will not be important. The fluctuations, it will not be important. So here's the canonical transformation I'm going to do. I'm going to take the upspin operators, and I'm going to multiply them by a factor e to the I phi I. So this is multiply e to the minus I phi I. And the downspin operators, I'm going to turn the whole operator into a particle operator. And besides this e to the I phi I factor, I'm going to multiply it by factor e to the I q naught ri, which is plus or minus 1 if I'm on a, what's that lattice called? And I'm going to choose this parameter phi I to be minus half q naught, the incommensurate vector dot ri. And when I do this, the new operators, the tildes, have all the right fermion commutation rules. So that's a canonical transformation. And the Hamiltonian transforms to H tilde, where U changes to U tilde, but the sign is changed. The chemical potential appears as a magnetic field. And the kinetic energy operator gets multiplied by a phase factor which depends upon spin. In other words, this is describing to you a model with spin orbit coupling. Okay? So this is an exact result. With the same canonical transformation, the transverse spin operator in one problem turns into a Cooper pair operator multiplied by a phase factor. So here is the Cooper pair creation operator, Cooper pair annihilation operator. And since it's a canonical transformation, if I am calculating the correlation function of S plus S minus at the incommensurate vector Q plus the small, this small q around it as a function of omega, in the original Hamiltonian, that is identical to the Cooper pair correlation at around q equal to 0 in the Hamiltonian H tilde. No, this is q naught plus q naught. Capital Q is q naught plus q naught. OK?
Chandra, but SCSC will also transform into a charge density wave.
That's,
so
that,
it has Heisenberg character, not XY character.
That's correct.
Okay.
Would you like to imagine I wasn't aware of that?
Not just like mentioning it from your
viewpoint.
So I don't know.
But I'm interested only in transverse correlation functions, because everything that has been measured will be for transverse correlations.
Chandra, is pi I, have you chosen yet?
Sorry?
Is pi I?
Yes, I have chosen that, and it is precisely the. This is a talk I should have given like Shankar on a board. Okay. Now, if I'm in two dimensions, so this is a pair of relations, one for the real part and one for the imaginary part of S plus S minus or delta plus delta minus, the phase correlations or the amplitude correlations of the Cooper pairs. And we very well know that in two dimension, this is calculable from the 2D XY model in two dimension. The spin orbit coupling does not hurt you, because I'm going to construct my operators from time reverse operators. And the incommensuration, if the incommensuration is large enough, there'll be no antiferromagnetism, which translates itself into no superconductivity at large enough Zeeman field. Okay, so this model also has a critical point as a function of the Zeeman field. So the use, now, I should say another statement, this will be important. The usual dissipation that you use for the antiferromagnetic model, omega times some coefficient times the order parameter square, and that coefficient is related to the antiferromagnetic vector that translates itself to the Caldera-Leggett dissipation for the XY model.
Right. Capital delta is an operator. Is that on the right hand side of S plus?
So what I'm trying to describe by this is that this is the correlation function of S plus S minus in the Hamiltonian H at certain set wave vector, just as this is.
So what's delta plus? Is it A?
A dagger, dagger.
Let's say this is this, and delta minus is this.
Okay. On the same side.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now I'm going to go to the next theoretical result, which is if I have a dissipative quantum XY model, can one calculate its quantum critical fluctuations? So let's first look at the classical XY model. And since these models that we are talking about, the kinetic energy goes in finite number of directions, the model automatically has a fourfold anisotropy, which is not there in, say, the XY model that Costless and Thales solved. But in the classical model, Jose Cardanoff, Nelson, Kirkpatrick showed that the fourfold anisotropy is marginally irrelevant. So the model I'm going to look at is, so the classical model has a coupling constant k. So in two dimension, the amplitude fluctuations are irrelevant, and we are only going to look at the phase fluctuations. It's cosine of the angle between them. So at each place, there is a vector, and this vector has an arbitrary direction. That's the theta field, and there is an angular thing. For the purpose of cuprates, I will add an additional thing, but I won't talk about this, and I will add the fourfold anisotropy. So we know that already classically, this model does not have a phase transition, which can be described by the usual spin wave theory or renormalized spin wave theory. for any such thing, it has a transition by binding of vortices worked out by Costless and Thales and various other people.
I know you said that you know about the Heisenberg theorem, but what is the justification for removing it now?
Because I am going to be dealing with transverse spin correlations.
No, but what? But if it's got Heisenberg characteristics, it will fluctuate in any direction it's allowed to involve also.
No, you remember I put an I sub z there in the beginning, in my Hamiltonian.
I don't see it.
No. If you look at that thing, you will discover that depending upon the sign of I sub z, it has either a superconducting transition or a charge density wave transition.
Can you use the total angular momentum? This formula commutes the total angular momentum.
No, it's a question of energetics. Do things order with charge density wave or spin density wave depends upon the magnitude of U.
So let me ask you a definite question. Which term does not commute with the total spin operator in that Hamiltonian? Apart from H, which obviously doesn't.
It is not required for me for the spin not to commute. Okay, it is not required for me. In fact, even the spin orbit coupling does.
The spin orbit term has only U1. It's got equal and opposite phases for up and down phases.
But that comes from the original Hopping of conserved total spin.
No, it comes from the IZ as the square term. Maybe you should show the original Hamiltonian.
No, I don't know. It's not a very relevant issue.
Chandra, spend a minute on this because I guess this question is relevant. IZ is only present
Let me emphasize. The theory that I'm going to describe is going to be true even if the ultimate order is icing order as long as I'm measuring transverse spin correlations. And therefore, this issue is not relevant, and I will not further go into it further. Okay. For the quantum model, I have to add the kinetic energy of rotors.
But you may have lost your audience at this point.
I certainly have lost you, but that has happened before.
Sarcasm doesn't make your equations correct.
What I'm telling you is an exact transformation.
I'm not going to come to that
till the end of the talk.
But that's an obstinacy which may come from the fact that it's wrong. Okay.
Hey, I'm obstinate.
You guys have lots of time to work this out and break
it. Okay.
So
I have to ask now.
So I'm going to also say that there is a dissipation of the Caldera-Leggett form, which comes in the model if the supercurrent decays into ordinary current. And in the case of the antiferromagnet, all that happens is that this K or Q translates into K plus capital Q, and then you can drop the K, and it is the kind of dissipation that everybody has been using. Now, the first people who looked at the problem, Matthew Fisher and Chakravarti, Kivelson, etc., suggested quite correctly that the model has a phase transition as a function of alpha, but nobody had calculated the correlation functions for this problem limit. Now, very surprisingly, this quantum model is as solvable as the classical XY model by Costless Thales with certain remarkable properties. And as always, if you can solve a problem, it's by finding the right variables. And what are the right variables in this case? So the right variables, and this is sort of common up to now with the way the classical XY models solve, begin with that. What you do is you make a Villain transformation so that cosine theta I minus theta j transforms into a set of parabolas labeled by integers. And these parabolas are displaced by each other by 2 pi, so they are labeling vortices, number of vortices. Now you define a link variable m. This is the difference between theta at this site and this site, call that m sub x, m sub y in the same way. So this would correspond to the velocity, gradient of theta corresponds to a velocity in this direction, velocity in this direction. Combine, define a positive x and a positive y direction, and define an m vector at each point instead of the links. A vector field can always be divided into a longitudinal part and a transverse part, as in the classical model. You define the curl of the vector field, the transverse part, as a vorticity pointed in the z direction. But the presence of dissipation in the problem insists that you also have a divergent part of the vector field. And here we choose a very peculiar definition of another topological object, which I'll show you in a moment, which is the time derivative of the divergence of M sub L. Now, I have written this in continuum. It is very important to do this problem keeping the discreteness of this rho v and rho w intact. Okay, and that can be done. So this is the ordinary vortex, and this we called a warp. So let me just remind you what a vortex is. Vortex simply means that there is a set of m's on nearby links such that if you integrate around it, you get 2 pi, and that cannot happen without a cut going all the way to the boundary of the sample, which is why a vortex is a topological object. What is a warp? What we are doing is going from one time step to the other and making a change in the divergence of m. Okay, that's what. So let's say this had some set of m sitting here and some set of thetas. And what I'm going to do is take a point here and suddenly change theta by 2 pi in a time step. So in that time step, that is taking the derivative. But if I change this theta by 2 pi without changing it in the vicinity, and if I define my positive x coordinate like that and positive y coordinate like that, I have changed my m by minus 1 here, minus 1 here, plus 1 here, plus 1 here. And therefore, I have changed at this point the divergence of m by 4 units. I'm taking a divergence like that, a divergence like that. I've changed it by 4 units. And at the surrounding points, I have changed it by minus 1. In this theory, divergence of m is a charge. Let's call it a monopole. So this is an instanton of 4 monopoles whose net charge is 0. And that will be important.
Chandra, just to clarify, you mentioned that m is the integer value field.
Mm-hmm.
So if I...
So in this picture, everything that I'm doing is integer. Right.
Is it defined modulo 2 pi? Is that correct?
It is defined modulo 2 pi, but as in all these theories, you imagine that the fugacity of having charges changing to 4 pi, 8 pi, 6 pi is so large that they do not occur.
So all I wanted to clarify for myself, and I apologize if it sounds trivial, was that this could be mapped on a Z2 gauge field theory that lives on the links and it's either plus pi or minus pi.
I do not, just the warp alone, yes.
Okay.
Not the vortex problem, not the two together. Okay. Okay. Now, here is an exact statement that after you have after you have made the Villain transformation and integrated over the spin waves, one finds that the action is exactly this plus some constant terms. And what are these terms? There is an interaction between a vortex at point r and time t, a vortex at time t, r prime t, same time, this should be tau, log of r minus r prime. In other words, there are vortices and they do not interact in time. Then there are warps, which can be anywhere, but they only interact in time, not in space. And why they don't interact, in space. And then there is a next term, which is like a which is like a Coulomb term in three dimension. This is like a Coulomb term in three dimension. Now, one of the many things that Polyakov proved is that a Coulomb term in three dimension does not have a phase transition. It maps to the loop gas. So, whereas we know that there is an interesting phase transition due to this and to this, and this object being a curl of something, a field, and this object being a divergence of a field, they are orthogonal objects. And therefore, if you ignore this term as at least marginally irrelevant, you can solve the problem exactly.
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused. I mean, I would maybe expect that if you go to 2 plus 1 dimension, you have some kind of vortex loops.
Yeah, let me put it this way. In all these problems, knowledge is dangerous. Okay, there is a way of transforming. There is a set of variables in which we can put the problem in the fashion that you have suggested. Okay? That's the traditional way. And then you cannot solve the problem. If you look at this paper, my paper with Vivekaji, that approach and what it leads to and why it's not soluble is discussed. Okay? So we found another set of variables where we can solve the problem. Okay, so I already said this. Okay, so let me just come to the chase. This thing has a complicated phase diagram, which I will show by quantum Monte Carlo. So I already said this. And then, if there is a part of the problem where the coefficient of the rho w term, which was related to dissipation, dominates the problem, then we can exactly, that is simply a one-dimensional time problem of fluctuating objects. And I already showed you they do not interact with each other in space because they're a charge surrounded by equal charges in the vicinity so that they have no interaction with other fellows of the same kind elsewhere, just plain electrostatics. You can calculate the correlation function and you find the correlation functions are at criticality, 1 over time. And again, I've written it in continuum. It actually gives you length scales on the scale of a lattice constant. And this is only at criticality. And the Fourier transform of this is precisely this. And what we have gained by 20 years of trying to look for after proposing the phenomenology is a factor of 2 here, and we know what the cutoff is, and we know what model gives this criticality. So Vivekaji and I also calculated the crossover functions, and they have some interesting Q dependences. Okay, so now let me... So I'm going to tell you about the calculation of the correlation functions on the same model, which will, I hope, satisfy you. You're Mr. Jill Targis?
No.
Okay. So, which? Yeah. So, here's a model where there's a moment of inertia. There's a coupling between k cosine theta I minus theta j and the dissipation. And we have calculated the phase diagram and various correlations. Okay? So, this is the quantum Monte Carlo calculated phase diagram for a fixed value of the kinetic energy. Here's the coupling, here's the dissipation. This is a t equal to zero phase diagram. Here's the disordered region. There's a region of parameter space where in some units k is much larger than alpha, in which case we observe a purely two-dimensional phase transition of the costless Thales type. Now, not only can we, the Lejeune does this calculation, but we can watch vortices and we can watch warps because we know what their signatures are. And we know that, and we can calculate their correlation function as well as the correlation function with the order parameter. This is a completely classical costless Thales transition in the sense that we can look at this region and do finite size scaling and get exactly the 2 pi over 8 jump of the helicity modulus that Koslitz and David Nelson had predicted. The warps do nothing here except that warps are very long range interacting in time. So when there is ordering at a finite length scale, the costless Thales order is in a finite length scale. You know, one hears so much about 2D XY model does not have an order. I came across a lovely paper by two French authors whose name I don't remember, who did large scale finite size scaling for the classical costless Thales transition. And it's a beautiful sentence in their paper. It says, to tell the difference between the costless Thales ordered phase and a truly ordered phase, we will have to do the numerical simulation on the size of the state of Texas. Okay. So anyway, we observe the same scaling. Okay. Now, then you can travel here and you find a fully ordered phase in which only the warps order, which we can watch. There is also an ordering here where the warps order, but they induce the ordering of vortices in the sense that there is not a jump of the helicity here, but a gradual increase of the helicity. But this region is truly ordered, meaning the finite size scaling here of the order parameter is quite different from here. This thing is hashed because we did not examine the details of how these three lines meet.
John, can I just ask a technical question? Did you take your effective model and put it on a lattice?
No. This is the original model.
It's the original model.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. That's a very good question, Piers.
All of the questions, except you inject yourself. So this is a finite temperature?
No, this is zero temperature. Meaning you do it with some particular number of time steps,
okay.
And
remind us what alpha is.
Sorry?
Remind us what alpha is.
Alpha is the dissipation parameter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now I'm going to tell you about correlation functions calculated across this line. So there was some value of the order of alpha of 0.0262 where we began to see order. And if you calculate this correlation function at the same point in space as a function of time, remember, these are correlation function of e to the I theta at one space and time with e to the I theta at another space and time. And you plot them as a function of time, they kind of look like this. You know something is happening because here they were going to zero fairly fast, and here they are approaching a finite value. There is some problems occasionally arising because the number of time steps is not very large. However, what I'm going to do now is to take the data in the disordered region close to criticality and put it all together. And when you do that, the data on the previous graph plus a hell of a lot more data, I plot as tau times the correlation function and plot it as tau over c tau to the half, which is the correlation function that Vivek and I had derived for the crossover to criticality. So you observe that g theta goes as 1 over tau e to the minus tau c tau to the half. And this is also a derived relation. And this should not be so surprising. It's not terribly different from what you would get in the costly Collins problem, where c of tau diverges so that it becomes a pure 1 over tau at criticality at alpha equal to alpha c. And here is c of tau by tau 0 plotted against alpha c over alpha c minus half. And this is a log scale. This is a linear scale. And you see that this relation is fulfilled. Vivek and I had derived this coefficient tau 0 for these parameters to be 0.063. In this simulation, it comes out to be 0.08. So we are obeying what's happening in space, in time.
Can I put that just when psi t goes to infinity, what happens?
Sorry?
When psi tau goes to
it infinity. Goes to 1 over tau.
No.
Oh, yes.
But look at this.
Oh, yes.
Sorry.
When south when
goes
when
to infinity, you get e to minus.
I think I've made a mistake. Here it should be t over psi t.
Ah, okay.
Here, like this.
Uh-huh.
I forgot.
Yeah. Okay. Then.
Look at the figure. Thanks for pointing it out. I'll correct that. What about spatial correlation? So I'm going to plot the correlation function at the same point in time as a function of space, and now I'm doing this as a function of x for all the various alphas, and you discover that independent of the value of how close to your criticality, it is going like this, and if you look at this scale, this correlation length is of order 1 independent of alpha. Now, we have also done g theta x tau, but because this thing is decreasing so fast, by the time we run into four lattice constants, we run out of computational ability to calculate this as a function of time. Within up to four, we observe it is almost the same, but there are some deviations. There are some weak deviations as we go to further lattice constants. But here you see there is at criticality, there is a near criticality. You see that there is no spatial length. So I think this is the first time in your life that you have seen a model exactly solved with local quantum critic hurt. We have also done this problem with the anisotropy, the H4 cosine theta, that was the cosine 4 theta, which was the pure XY model before. And analytically, we find that while Koslitz, well, Thales and Kardanoff and whatnot, no, Kardanoff and Nelson and whatnot had proven that fourfold anisotropy is marginally irrelevant in the classical problem, in the quantum problem, it's irrelevant. We have done an anisotropy parameter as large as 5 in units of k, and we find the same locality. Okay, so this is the summary. Quantum criticality of some models in 2D with appropriate dissipation can only be described by topological excitations. In XY models with fourfold or higher anisotropy, I'm in fact not even sure of this statement now because we have some preliminary results on twofold anisotropy. Which we haven't fully analyzed, but this statement may even be true there, that you have some topological excitations leading to spatial locality and omega over t scaling. This statement that I'm making is a little complicated than it appears. What I mean by that is that you've got these fluctuations, and these fluctuations are in a fermionic problem, and you have to then worry about renormalization of the fluctuation spectrum fermions, and is the theory still stable? And we have some results in it's been done. So directly applicable to cuprates, and at least to the simple antiferromagnetic quantum critical problem. But if you have to apply to questions of details of heavy fermions and iron compounds, then you have to probably see whether the realistic terms that you put in are indeed not relevant. That there is a universality class to which the other things are not relevant. That has to be seen yet. Okay. Thank you.
Question. Chandra, if I look at the model that you're doing in terms of the warps and the vortices, it looks manifestly, if you interpret those rows as sort of two variables. So the model written in terms of the warps and the vortices looks symmetric in time and in space. Meaning that if I look at the action that you've written, right, you have a piece that goes like delta function time times, 1/4, log.
Yeah, one is a one-dimensional problem, the other is a two-dimensional problem. That's a big difference.
Oh, I see. So is that why the final correlation function, that's my question, is that why the time dependence is very different from the spatial dependence?
No, there is another rather remarkable difference in the problem. I am proud to say, is a very clever question. You see, you have to ask yourself, if you had just these two terms in the problem, then the phase diagram would look like this. Disordered, both warps and vortices ordered, vortices ordered, warps ordered. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the essential physics of changing this phase diagram from this to this is in this last term. Okay? This is not an innocent term. It's clear that it does things. Vivek and I were not able to handle this term analytically. But now that we know the answers, we have handed this problem over to a clever graduate student. It turns out that it may be soluble to see under what conditions you arrive at the phase diagram analytically. Okay. So it is. You see, these involve only warps and not vortices, uh-huh. And that's important.
And microscopically, what does this term correspond to in terms of your XY model? Which term in the XY model does this come from?
Each of these terms, the way that they appear is completely non-trivial. They are coming from all terms. It's a rearrangement of terms to appear in this fashion. Somehow I had an evil thought that if I'm to get local criticality, I should get variables which are orthogonal in space and time. So I started rearranging, I knew the answer at the back of the book from the experiments. So I started rearranging terms, and I found such a thing, but that involves, it's not like this term is that and that term is that. Yeah, I've not even specified for you the appropriate coefficient in front here.
Maybe on a more physics ground. You started with the model of some magnetic transition in itinerant system at some incommensurate momentum q, and you ended up with the local quantum criticality when your observables do not depend on momentum. How should we understand?
Yeah, I should. Can I make a sure. slight amendment mm-hmm. to that statement? All I can say at this point, even given these calculations, is that the metric of space is not blowing up while the metric of time is blowing up near criticality. Okay?
It should be translated as frequency dependency.
Because as I said, there is a in the Monte Carlo calculation, there is a weak dependence if I go away from x equal to zero mm-hmm. on C of tau. Okay. That has not been fully investigated. Okay, but given that, what I'm saying is that here is a model. This model obviously applies to the superconductor insulator transition, which is driven by alpha. And it, I believe, certainly in that model of the cuprates which I have, where there are four directions of a polar time reversal vector order, it directly applies. And what I've discovered is that it applies to at least the simplest itinerant anti-ferromagnetic
order. And this is what I'm asking.
Incidentally, what happened to Pierce?
He's
in
Hawaii.
He's in Hawaii.
Oh. You see, originally I had introduced an anisotropy term, Sz square. Sz square commutes with everything in the Hamiltonian.
Okay. Your susceptibility, mm-hmm. if I calculate magnetic susceptibility, apparently it loses momentum dependence at the critical point.
I'm looking at the problem near criticality. Okay?
Okay.
So it is not clear to me from my solution whether this thing extends over a certain region in Q space or it extends all the way to Q equal to zero from the incommensurate vector. I cannot make statements of that kind. And also, these things are going to depend upon, you know, I can say some things precisely at criticality, but criticality is a meaningless quantity without specifying approach to it. And I cannot make very precise statements on the approach to it.
Any further questions?
Would you like to have another R talk application to pictides, five-fold model, three-fold model?
Until you're back at the end of the week, it would spoil our conversations with you.
Superconductivity. All right. Just kidding. Oh, just to annoy you.
Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, then Ben and Chandra will both be able to week. Thank you.